Today is Thursday, the 12th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A new report details widespread sexual violence in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
This is the first major human rights investigation into sexual violence in the context of the conflict.
Plus, how did the Taliban make such quick gains on the ground?
Now, there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that the Afghan government was taken by surprise when President Biden announced that he would withdraw all forces from Afghanistan.
Well, of these stories and more next. Amnesty International released a report on Wednesday detailing sexual assaults against women by Ethiopian soldiers and their allies in the conflict-torn Tigray region. Amnesty has tallied more than 1,200 cases of sexual violence that were recorded by health centers in Tigray between February and April of this year. Joining us is Amnesty International Senior Crisis Advisor and author of the report, Donatella Rivera. Donatella, as the author of the report, what do you see as the most important key takeaway from it?
This is the first major human rights investigation into sexual violence in the context of the conflict that has been raging in Tigray since November of last year. Having investigated sexual violence in wars across the Middle East and Africa, this is one of the worst situations that I've come across in more than 20 years doing this work. In addition to the rape and other form of sexual violence, other forms of torture that has been inflicted on hundreds and hundreds of women and girls since the beginning of the conflict in Tigray, particular effort seems to have been made by the perpetrators to inflict maximum physical and emotional psychological damage on the women and girls that were subjected to these atrocities, durable damage. So rapes were very often gang rapes by multiple perpetrators, often in front of the survivors' families, in front of their children. Women and girls were held for days and weeks in situation of sexual slavery, during which they were repeatedly raped by multiple perpetrators. They were subjected to the forms of mutilation. Some women had nails, pieces of metals inserted into their womb. And these atrocities were perpetrated by all the forces that were acting on behalf of the Ethiopian government. And they were committing these atrocities from day one all over the Tigray region, and they continued to do so for months and months and months.
The research in the report also states that there have been over 1,200 documented cases of sexual assault in Tigray over the span of a few months. But I was wondering if you could comment on what kind of assistance and help these women and girls are receiving.
First of all, these 1,288 cases that were registered just between February and April. And these were registered in those very, very few health centers that are functioning and that exist only in the main cities. So they're only really accessible to a small percentage of the population, because the rural population who cannot get to these, to the big city, has had no medical care at all. And many of the survivors we've interviewed have had no medical care at all, no psychosocial support. The humanitarian situation in Tigray is absolutely dire for everyone.
Given that that is the current situation there, what needs to be done to really put forward and get the help, not only to those who have come forward and are at these health clinics that you have identified, but to so many more who don't have those resources?
This is a man-made humanitarian crisis. The government of Ethiopia has imposed restriction on the work and on the activities of the humanitarian workers, and that has been documented. But the reason why humanitarian aid is not getting in is not so much an issue of resources, is an issue of political will, the same political will that is lacking to investigate and to take action against the perpetrators of these atrocities. It's really, really important that the international community goes beyond statements of concerns and statements condemning what's happening, but that it actually moves to put real pressure, to bring pressure to bear on those who have carried out the atrocities, who have allowed the atrocities to be committed for such a prolonged period of time. Take action to stop the violation and to bring to justice those responsible.
Donatella Rivera is a senior crisis advisor for Amnesty International. VOA reached out to the Ethiopian government through its embassy here in Washington for a comment, but did not receive a reply. The head of a group the Ethiopian government considers a terrorist organization has formed a military alliance with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which has been fighting the Ethiopian government in the Tigray region since last November. The alliance was announced by the Oromo Liberation Army leader in an interview on Wednesday with the Associated Press. The alliance brings together the TPLF, which ruled Ethiopia for 3 decades and now controls Tigray, and the OLA, which last year left the opposition party, the Oromo Liberation Front. News of the alliance comes 1 day after the Ethiopian government appealed on Tuesday to citizens to join the military to end the fighting in the embattled northern Tigray region. Algerian officials are blaming arsonists for setting many of the fires raging in the mountainous region east of the capital of Algiers and in more than a dozen other provinces. Algerian state TV says 65 people have been killed thus far, including 28 soldiers who were trying to extinguish the fires and rescue those trapped by the flames. Edward Uranian has the details.
Fires raged Tuesday and into Wednesday in the mountainous region of Tizi Ouzou as fire crews, soldiers, and ordinary residents tried to douse the flames before they spread further. Algerian media reported that at least 79 major fires were burning in at least 17 provinces of the country. While the fires reportedly began Monday, many more appeared to ignite Tuesday, prompting the country's interior minister, Kamel Beljoud, to insist that many had been set by arsonists. He says that some experts are arguing these fires were deliberately set, but they are obviously criminal in nature because it's impossible for dozens of fires to ignite at almost the same time without some criminal hand being behind these acts. At least 3 arsonists have been captured by Algerian security services during the past several months after several other fires were ignited. Many Western media outlets are downplaying the arson claims and blaming wildfires, excessive heat, or global warming. Ali Mahmoudi, head of the Algerian Forest Department, told state TV that many of the fires ignited suddenly and about the same time Tuesday, leading to speculation that many were deliberately set. He says that initially there were 5 fires in the Tizi Ouzou region, and then suddenly after 2 p.m., the number of fires started going up hour after hour, and in some cases, minute after minute, until there were 58 fires burning. Canal Algérie, a French-Algerian TV network, warned residents of the country to be vigilant, 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 and keep an eye out for anyone setting fires. It also thanked the military and fire crews for their valiant efforts in extinguishing the fires and saving lives. An Algerian military commander was shown on amateur video ordering his soldiers into a region engulfed with flames to try and save the residents who are trapped in their houses. At least 28 soldiers have been killed in the ongoing fires. Algerian Prime Minister Ayman Ben Abderrahman told Algerians in a televised address Tuesday night that all efforts were being made by the government to compensate those who have lost their homes or livestock or family members. He says that a government delegation is visiting the regions hit by fire to determine the size of losses from the disaster and are being instructed to indemnify all those who have incurred losses, in addition to housing for those who have lost their homes in hotels or government facilities. Algerian media reports the government has contacted a number of regional countries to seek help with planes equipped to combat the fires. Major fires are also raging in Greece, Turkey, Lebanon, and Syria. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Firefighters in Greece continue to battle wildfires as officials defend their response amid unusually high temperatures and dry conditions. The government has pledged $586 million in aid to help those affected by the fires, including a massive blaze on Evia Island that has been burning for more than a week. More than 900 firefighters have been working to bring the Evia fire under control. Hundreds of evacuees fleeing the Dixie Fire in the western U.S. state of California have nowhere to go. Reuters' Zachary Goldman continues our coverage.
Evacuees who fled the raging Dixie Fire in Northern California left their homes with whatever they could carry and wound up here, a parking lot in the town of Susanville with nowhere to go. 48-year-old Greg Norton from the town of Chester told Reuters about the frantic dash that led him and his wife here.
We could see the fire cresting over the mountain on its way into the Chester area. And frantic phone calls to family members who are in the area, we need to get out, where are we meeting at? Trying to set up rendezvous points for where we were going to meet everybody and plan our next move after that.
The Dixie Fire has scorched almost 500,000 acres. That's an area larger than the city of Houston. It's now the second largest blaze recorded in state history. 88-year-old Betty Sickley fled the nearby town of Westwood last week with her seven dogs and other pets.
So we took the animals and left. We got a bird in there and a cat in there and these seven dogs. But we take care of all of them.
The evacuees have had help from American Red Cross volunteers.
They have been wonderful. They bring us three meals a day. They do the laundry. Oh, I told somebody that long, this has been the cheapest camping trip I've ever had.
More than 5,000 firefighters are currently tackling the Dixie Fire. For 76-year-old Robert Johns of Greenville, going back means confronting everything that's lost.
It really hasn't hit me hard yet, but I think it will when I get back in town. And I see all these people that are just totally devastated. It just breaks my heart.
Zachary Goldman reports for Reuters News. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Fighting continues to spread across Afghanistan, with the Taliban taking control of three more provincial capitals and a local army base as the U.S. and NATO forces complete their withdrawal. This gives the organization control of roughly two-thirds of the country and comes on the day where Afghanistan President Ashraf Ghani visited Balkh province, seeking support to oppose the Taliban offenses. VOA Asia's Ira Melman caught up with VOA's Aisha Tanzim in Kabul to discuss the latest events.
The latest that we have is that the Taliban have taken over nine provincial capitals. They started on Friday, and as we have been reporting, and by yesterday, they took over the ninth capital. And after that, now they're in full control of the entire northeast and a large part of the north of the country. So the situation is becoming dire. There are only one or two provincial capitals left in the north. One of them that the Taliban have attacked or tried to take over multiple times is Mazar-e-Sharif. On Sunday, Mazar was in panic because the Taliban said they were attacking, but they couldn't manage it. They were stopped 20 kilometers from the city. So today, President Ghani is in Mazar-e-Sharif along with warlord and the highest ranking military official in Afghanistan, Marshal Abdur-Rashid Dostum. What he's trying to do is to stop this momentum of Taliban by drumming up support among old warlords who can mobilize people into what they're calling locally as public uprising forces. We need to remember that in Herat, it was one old warlord, Ismail Khan, who managed to stop the onslaught of Taliban. Yes, he was helped by ANDSF, but he's the one who took the lead. So if these public uprising forces organize, and if the old warlords manage to mobilize them, it could be definitely a boost for the Afghan defense and security forces.
Why has it been so relatively easy for the Taliban to make such gains?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that the Afghan government was taken by surprise when President Biden announced that he would withdraw all forces from Afghanistan. Despite public stance by the U.S. that it wanted to withdraw, nobody really believed that U.S. would withdraw to the last man. Almost everybody in the region believed that the U.S. would leave some footprint on the ground and they would continue their air support, etc. And my information is that even U.S.'s NATO allies were shocked by this news. They weren't prepared for it. There are a couple of things. One is the Afghan, you can say they became a little complacent because the U.S. was around with air support and did not plan as well as Taliban did. The second thing is that in some things, you know, the training was still ongoing and the Afghan Air Force in particular and how to use the Air Force. The training was supposed to go on for a couple more years before they became independent. And the third thing is a complaint that the Afghan government has against the U.S., which is they claim that when the U.S. negotiated that deal, the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, when he negotiated the deal with Taliban, on one hand, the Afghan government was excluded from that deal. On the other hand, the U.S. Bound the hands of the Afghan government and did not allow them to attack Taliban, only defend themselves. And so the Taliban got the freedom of movement to pre-position themselves for the time after the deal, which is when they started their attack. Some of it has also been because a lot of the areas that the Taliban initially took over were far-off areas. They were rural areas. They were districts that were not well defended. A lot of these forces had not been well supplied because the Taliban controlled some of the roads getting to these areas. So morale in those areas was already down. So the Taliban, when they attacked those areas first and then released videos of soldiers surrendering or running away or retreating, and at the same time, you had news of U.S. leaving and it wasn't clear how much air support would be available. And then you had all these stories coming out of how the Afghan military was unprepared and how it could not manage its own air force. All of that combined led to really shooting down the morale of Afghan army and Afghan defense, security and defense forces.
Aisha Tanzim is VOA's Pakistan and Afghanistan bureau chief, and she was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman from Kabul. Delegations from the Taliban, Afghanistan, and Pakistan met on Wednesday in Doha, Qatar. Shah Mahmood Qureshi, Pakistan's foreign minister, said that his government was still advocating for peace.
We have done whatever we could, and we will continue to do what we can for peace, for stability, and for regional connectivity.
Joining us now is Jason Campbell, policy researcher with the RAND Corporation in Washington.
So Jason, where I wanted to begin our conversation is here. If we look at the comments that are coming out of Doha for this extended Troika talk, Pakistan, the Taliban, and the Afghan delegation all say that they're committed to the peace process. But both sides have also said that the Taliban will not recognize a government with Ashraf Ghani in it. The Afghanistan government says that Ashraf Ghani is the duly elected president, so any new government needs to be included with him until the end of his term. What do you make out of the comments and the process that's taking place in Doha?
Sure. Well, I think just at the outset, it's important to point out that, you know, you're always going to have every side stating that they're committed to a peace process or that they support peace. And that may be accurate, but the bigger question is always, you know, under what terms? And that's where I think you find a pretty considerable divergence. And I think that's what we're seeing here coming out of Doha. The issue is that as of yet, the Taliban have not articulated really in any way a clear political vision for Afghanistan. You know, there have been periodically some statements that are a little bit more pragmatic, that they, you know, state that, you know, they want to be part of, they're willing to be part of a more inclusive governing system that doesn't necessarily have them in the dominant position. But they haven't gone really beyond that in many ways. So the stakeholders here are left sort of continually trying to reassess what it is the Taliban want, particularly given that what we're seeing on the ground in Afghanistan is increasingly divergent from some of the statements that are made in Doha. On the Afghanistan government side, I think that is, again, sort of the expected soundbite, is that they are remain committed to the duly elected president and that he should finish out his term. But I think in reality, all sides here understand that, you know, getting to some sort of a stable political outcome in Afghanistan is not simply a matter of incorporating the Taliban into the current governing structure.
So moving forward, Jason, taking a look, as you mentioned, the situation on the ground, from a policy standpoint, from, you know, a practicality standpoint, what do you see moving forward?
What is going to interest me in the days and weeks ahead is going to be the degree to which the Taliban, one, continue to kind of press their current advantage in and around other provincial capitals, and two, the degree to which they become sort of hunkered down in those provincial capitals that they've recently taken. What we've seen periodically, and not just in recent months, but over the years, is that the Taliban will go in and, you know, take over a city center, a provincial center, a district center. They will, you know, chase out the Afghan security forces. They will raise their flag and they will, you know, film it, take pictures, and kind of reap the propaganda victory. And then in a few weeks or days or weeks, they will be again, relinquish that that territory, usually in the face of a response by the Afghan security forces. But the damage is already done because they've been able to, again, bolster their narrative that the momentum is on their side and they're going to inevitably take over. I think longer term, or in the medium term, I think the Taliban has to be wary of taking over too much ownership of territory, because in so doing, they kind of de facto become the local governance structure. And I think that the Taliban have proven to be fairly a poor governing entities in the past, and are not perhaps as unified as they appear to be when it comes to how best to, again, actually manage and govern some of these local areas.
That was RAND Corporation policy researcher Jason Campbell. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Law enforcement authorities in Western Australia have said that a new mobile interpreting app will help improve relations with Indigenous communities, especially in areas where English is not commonly spoken. Phil Mercer has that story.
The technology translates a few common police directions into local languages and has been devised with an Aboriginal interpreting service. The so-called Yarning app allows Western Australian police officers to select from 8 Aboriginal languages and play key messages relating to rights in custody and the COVID-19 pandemic. Indigenous leaders believe it will save lives by preventing the wrongful imprisonment of people who don't understand the legal process. The technology will be available in communities where English is often the third or fourth most commonly used language. Chris Dawson is the Western Australia Police Commissioner. He says the app will build trust with Indigenous communities.
What better way to communicate than in language? In the sense that we can now offer additional information to overcome confusion or to overcome fear, doubt, whatever it might be. This app is a world first.
Critics, though, say the app is too basic and ignores deeper problems of racism within Australia's justice system. Aboriginal Australians are some of the most incarcerated people on earth, according to a report commissioned by the government in Canberra in 2019. Relations with the police have often been fraught. Western Australia has the country's highest rate of Indigenous youth detention. A criminology study by the University of Technology Sydney said that since 1991, the number of Indigenous inmates in Australia has more than doubled, from 14% to 29% of the total prison population. More than 780 Indigenous languages are identified by First Languages Australia, an organisation dedicated to saving linguistic heritage. It says about 20 languages are used every day by fluent speakers. Australia's original inhabitants make up about 3.3% of the Australian population, according to a 2016 Australian census, but suffer high rates of poverty, ill health, and unemployment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, North India's Kulu district is famed for its ancient tradition of spinning hand-woven stoles and shawls with designs that have been passed down for generations. Now artisans, many of whom are women, are learning to make another traditional Indian garment called the sari. It's part of a program sponsored by the local government and private sector that aims to reach new markets and enhance income opportunities for women. Anjana Pasricha rounds us out.
These artisans deftly weave traditional designs into the woolen fabric that they spin on looms at a workshop in North India's Kulu region. In addition to the traditional shawls made for decades, they are weaving another popular garment worn by women in India and other South Asian countries, the sari.
So to give it a variety and a new twist, we introduced this fabric, which is called sari, and I'm very hopeful that the tourist who is coming to this district will definitely take it as a souvenir.
They will be among the first woolen saris, which are usually made of cotton and silk. Authorities are optimistic that adding them to shop shelves will boost income opportunities in this hilly district for artisans, especially women, who have woven garments with ethnic Kulu designs for centuries in their homes.
This work is very good for women. With the income, we can educate our children and live well.
At workshops, broader looms have replaced the old ones so that artisans can weave fabric with a wider width needed for saris. Demand for hand-woven garments, often made from local yarn, has risen in recent decades, according to a manufacturer.
Handloom fabrics have more warmth because they are uneven. Fabric made on power looms cloth does not have gaps, so it cannot trap body heat.
Enhancing the appeal of garments to a more fashion-conscious public has also helped boost sales.
To keep pace with the times and increase sales, we have consulted fashion institutes and started following global fashion forecasting trends.
The artisans have adapted to a new format quickly.
They are expert in making motifs on the fabric, so we just have to train them about the particular width and length of the sari, plus the weight of the sari. It should not be very heavy, because otherwise it will be very uncomfortable to wear.
While an ancient tradition is getting a new spin, much will depend on luring young people to learn the painstaking art.
Now, computers and phones are what interests them. So sometimes local people are hesitant to come, thinking their efforts may not fetch much value.
For the time being, some are weaving dreams into the project. Javitri Thakur, who learned the art to support her family, hopes making saris will open new avenues for her.
It's good. Maybe I can start my own business one day.
It remains to be seen if the Kulu designs can fulfill such aspirations. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, Thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.